Hi guys, welcome back to Having a Ball podcast. I am your host, Erica.
And I'm Lucy.
And today is sort of a much more special episode. We have the authors of Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography. Now, if you know that name, it's because we referenced it on our previous, I think it was either June or July, episode of our Bob Crane biography. And this is one of the mega sources that we use. So it's really awesome to have Carol Ford and Linda Groundwater, all the way from Australia, joining us here today. So thanks, ladies, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us along.
Yeah,
Thank you
and
very much.
what I love is it's like having the book's voices here, which what you do is have a voice for the person you're writing about, right? And so I know just by, I think, Lucy, you might have the book there with you. It's a pretty big book, which
Oh, it's
means
extensive. I mean, you guys
it's a
did
labor of
so much
love.
work. What,
Yes.
it's like 400 pages, 500 pages?
Six
It's
or
extensive.
six.
Or
Wow.
six. There you go. I'm sorry.
So the big
That was.
question is, how long did it take you from, hey, let's write this book to, oh my gosh, it's published
We
and it's
wrote
out there and it's
it. Yeah.
out there in the world?
It took a long time.
It took 12 years to get it from when we actively said time to do something to getting it published and done. 12 years and 200 people.
More than,
Wow.
more
And
than.
so,
More than that.
I mean, I read your book, but like you guys did, you wrote the book. So like you guys did all that research. So like
And well,
we're here.
first, you know, both Linda and I and Dee by extension, we do want to thank you for caring about Bob. I mean,
Oh, I love him.
Bob Crane has really gotten a bum rap since his murder.
Yes.
The movie Autofocus did a huge amount of damage, for him, for his legacy. People who love Bob, who grew up with him, who knew him, people from Hogan's Heroes, people from all walks of his life were absolutely appalled and disgusted by that film. It never should have been made.
Oh
And
yeah. And I
so,
think we hit on the on it in the in our episode is that Lucy didn't watch it purposely because of her adoration, kind of like, you know, this podcast is about Lucille Ball. I felt the same way about the film that was released, but I came to it just as a person who isn't as has an extensive knowledge of it, but I could just tell watching it that the salaciousness of it was really what was being trying to be sold. And so I could I watch it saying, I know there's a story behind all of this raunchy stuff you're throwing at me because it's Hollywood. And so that's where a book like yours comes in, and people who write stories like this about Bob Crane.
The hard part with Bob's story is that, and especially with films like Autofocus, which is actually based on a book called The Murder of Bob Crane by John Graysmith,
Yes.
is that,
Robert Graysmith.
sorry, Robert
That's
Graysmith,
okay.
sorry, brain just went there, is that there are many things in it that not only are blown out of proportion, but never actually happened. But once something is put on film, it becomes reality.
The creative
Right.
liberties are
Yeah.
I mean,
insane.
kind
I
of
mean,
like
we see that right now with The Crown, where as we
Oh,
get
yes.
closer and closer and closer to modern day, if you're taking, I mean, looking at that really quickly back to the 1940s and 50s, it's far, far away. But now, as we're getting closer and closer and closer to modern day, and the princes are grown, Princess Diana has passed, now we're starting to get into really dangerous territory with the royal family. And that is how Autofocus looks at Bob's life. It takes that all of the low-hanging fruit, you might say, and just makes it this whole big story. And that is then what people home in on, because most people will, I mean, thankfully there are still a lot of readers, but most people will go grab a movie before they'll sit down and invest into reading a book. They have
A
to really,
book.
really want to read that, or are being forced to read it because it's mandatory reading. But that film is kind of, it blockaded us when Linda first started the project way back.
It was awful.
KNX slammed the door on
literally
Linda and said,
literally
get out.
Slammed the door on my face. Not talk about Bob Crane. Slam.
And we got that a lot. I will not talk about Bob Crane. I will not talk about Bob Crane. And it took an enormous amount of work on Linda's part, on Dee's part, on my part, to win the trust of people who had been burned by this film and then the fallout from it. Paul Schrader, he has even come out to say, like, this film was just, salaciousness just for the sake of salaciousness. But he said, Carpenter was not as important in Crane's life as he is in the film.
You would think it was a biography on them both. And I think, to your point, it's like they take, like recently, I think a lot of people are upset about the Marilyn story out on Netflix.
Yes,
and so I feel like what they do is with these big icons, they'll take the most part you can exploit the most and make a film around that. So it's not, so someone has a drinking problem, let's go there. Someone has a sex addiction problem, let's put that out there. Mm-hmm. Someone drugs, all
absolutely
of that.
Right.
But you forget the soul behind it, the talent. And Lucy, what she did in our podcast was she made sure that she put out his charitable work and everything else.
I loved that.
I'm glad I did something right.
You
did many things right.
Many things out there that it's hard to, if you take more than one source, you're going to get a lot of contradictory information. And not all of those sources are, shall we say, as reliable or thorough as others. And of course, we'll always say that we are the source.
So it becomes like the game of telephone.
That's what we have.
Right.
That's what we would naturally do anyway. But we know, for instance, ourselves, that we did literally speak with more than 200 people. We went to firsthand sources as often as we could. We got, we got family, we got friends, we got workmates, we got audio tapes that were in the family from Bob himself that no one else has ever had. There are things that are not in the book because we respected privacy and secrets and whatnot. That and so it was incredibly humbling and such a great privilege when people did speak with us, because they had seen and heard things that were so hurtful and to them so wrong. And I think it was Lucy that said, understood that what happened after Bob died, when the cast and crew of Hogan's Heroes all said, if you want to talk to us about Bob,
we'll talk now about the good
passed,
things, right?
Yeah. We would like to tell you about what it was like for us. And they didn't want to hear any of that. And so they just got shut down.
That was in your book, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
They got shut down. And that
got
was
shut
told
down,
to
right?
by family of cast.
And that's amazing that they stood together. I mean, and I know that we were talking about, like, on a much larger scale, like the idea that, Lucy and Vivian had such this huge rival. I mean, if you talk to anyone, I still have people today that are like, well, they weren't really friends, right?
And so it's really like,
how
I just mentioned,
let me explain,
like, right? And so I feel like for, as authors, you guys, you're like, this is my work, and like, let me explain to you how wrong you are, in a nice way,
stop.
In a very nice way. Like,
so let me take you both back to the beginning of this project for you, or maybe even the beginning of the interest of Bob Crane for you.
Yeah, how did
because
you get interested in it?
Is it a natural love that you both came together and said, let's write this? What started this? What started?
No.
No.
Well, like, no. We kind of all, the three of us kind of came at it from, we just, the universe.
Yeah, the universe brought us together pre-Facebook. Mm-hmm. Pre-Facebook.
So, yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, no, it was way back. It was
not pre-internet, but pre-Facebook.
Yeah. Right, pre-Facebook, yeah. It was when Yahoo Groups, that you remember? The,
Oh, yes.
But it was Erica. When the
listeners were out there before
MySpace. And, you know,
what was it? When did autofocus come out? 2002.
2002.
So and in 2003, I was at my mother-in-law's house and she had cable, and cable was a fairly new thing in Australia at the time. And my mother-in-law had cable and the TV was on, and it happened to be on Hogan's Heroes, which, by the way, has not stopped running ever since I have been here. And I have been here for more than 25 years.
Yes.
So just to give you an idea of how it runs.
Yes.
But funny how the residuals didn't kick in until the 80s. And I saw Hogan's Heroes. I went, oh, wow, I remember this show. Because I used to watch it with my dad when I was a kid. I didn't remember any of the plots, but I knew all the characters. And I knew that it was, my dad loved it and it was funny. And I remembered watching it on Sunday nights. He had it on reruns on Channel 38. And I said, gee, I remembered that Bob Crane had died, and I couldn't remember how. And I was only a child when that happened, I'm pleased to say. And I looked it up.
Oh.
And I said, oh, my goodness, that's right. He was murdered. And I remembered that I wasn't allowed to read the papers when it happened. But dug underneath all the, it was sex, murder, sex. And underneath all of that was drumming, radio, you know, television.
And very little of it.
But those little bits that I did read, I went, oh my goodness, look at this. There's a whole person under this, and it's all been buried. And that's so unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I need to do something about this. I have no idea what created that thought in my head, but it was just, I have to do something about this. And the old radio and journalist part of me said, well, I'll be the person to do something about this, from all the way down here in Australia, which God knows how I was going to do that. And so I started reaching out. I started by reaching out to WICC, and I found Bob's cousin, Jim Senich. God rest his soul. He just passed away earlier this year. Beautiful, beautiful man. And he just said, yes, please, please. I would love someone to do something about Bobby. You know, wasn't an angel. He always called Bob Bobby. He said, you know, he wasn't an angel, but he didn't walk around with horns sticking out of his head. And I would really love it if you would do this. And so I started coming up against walls, but each person helped get the next person. And then I went on Yahoo Groups, I think, in the next year. And that's when Carol came along. Pick her up, Carol.
And yeah, I was going to say, Carol, how did you get, interested in all this?
Way back when I was a kid, back in 1984, 85, I was in junior high school, middle school. And
shut up.
Yeah. Well, I was actually in high school. It was my 10th grade year. So
shut up.
You don't want to know when I was in high school then?
I won't mention those boys anymore.
So I had actually started watching Hogan's Heroes because of my dad as well. My dad was a huge MASH fan, and by extension, Hogan's Heroes, and also WKRP. But that's another podcast. Mm-hmm. But I started watching, and similar to Linda, I liked the characters. I liked the show, but this is all going back. This is pre-internet. This is pre-anything. And there was nothing. Today we hop on Google and we can just plug anything in and mm-hmm. find pretty much anything we want. Back in 1985, it was, you went to the library or you went to the bookstore. And maybe if you were lucky, there was a book, like an anthology book that had, you know, a little snip of Hogan's Heroes in it. And so that's where I found out Bob Crane had been murdered, because I was I was born in 1969. So I was, I had no idea he had been murdered in 1978. But I found that out. And then my little 15-year-old self was like, I must do something about this. So I started going to the library, and I started going into the microfilms and microfiche rooms, and just finding just the just from the basic facts that I knew, I could find when the, you know, Scottsdale, Arizona, and the date. And I found a few newspaper clippings, and I found a few newspaper clippings of Hogan's Heroes. But it was very, very sparse, because we just didn't have that kind of resource like we do today to be able to do the type of research that we can do today. And so fast forward through the end of high school, college, married, divorced, and we get to the early 2000s, and Linda posts on this Yahoo group that I had actually helped create with two other ladies who were huge fans of Hogan's Heroes, where she says, I am researching Bob Crane's life for a new series biography. You know, does anybody have any connections or whatever, however she said it. And my first thought was, good luck with that. Because at that point I had already, you know, it's like, this is not going to be an easy thing.
No.
And the next thing we know is Linda and I are talking and going back and forth, and I'm saying, this is a great idea, and this is what I've done. And she's saying, okay. And in amongst all of that, we have Dee Young, who worked at WICC. She retired a few years ago, but she met Bob when Bob came back to the station in 1976 to help the station celebrate its 50th anniversary. And she was just there. She called her, she was considered a Nicky New Kid. And she saw him come out of the elevator and that big smile, and just the whole room lights up. And he shook her hand and said, hi, you know, and she said, I will remember that for.
He
for
sounded like a charming man.
He was.
Yeah.
He truly was.
Truly was. And so, anyone who spoke to, sorry, Carol. Anybody who spoke about him, whether they liked him or not. So I can think specifically, for instance, of Paul Peterson here, who was not necessarily overwhelmed by him, but said, but did admit a certain genius to him as well. Said, whether you liked him or not, you were drawn. People were drawn to him. He was charming. He walked into a room and your eyes went in that direction. And it wasn't just that he was a good looking guy. And let's face it, he was. He was a very good looking man. But it was his. Yes. It was. I got no problem admitting that. Okay.
But and this is why we watch Hogan's Heroes. Eye candy 101.
But he, you know, he just drew. He was charismatic. He was kind. He was friendly. He was funny. He was naturally funny.
And he was just genuine.
Drew people to him.
He was genuine in all of that.
So to get all the from the start of your book, which of course starts with the childhood through working at the first radio station, working his way up to LA and all of that. How did you gather the, because you don't just have, he grew up here and he did this. You have information of that no one else has of his life. I mean, you know,
that's a bonus of 200 people.
It took a lot.
200 people is a lot of people.
It took a lot.
And you know what? It started out with like six, you know, didn't it, Carol?
Well, it grew. So for instance, you know, the very first people that came on board were, Jim. As Linda said, Jim Senich. And that's a big one. That's a big one right out of the gate. He's his blood cousin, his first cousin. The next person or close to the top that came on board was Reverend Ed Beck. We did not know he was going to even respond. He ended up responding. Linda, we wrote letters to him. And Linda at that time had written him regular snail mail from Australia to Arizona, where he was living. And we didn't know what we were going to get back. So let's just say that we didn't know what we were going to hear. We wanted to hear good things. We didn't know if we were going to hear good things. We didn't know what was going to come back to us when we put those requests out. But Reverend Ed Beck sent Linda those tiny little
cassette tapes. I had to buy a machine specifically to play the darn little cassette tape.
And then the transcription process of that, and then pulling that from the the small cassette tape and then putting it into an MP3 file, which in that time was brand new technology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I over here had wires hanging from every aspect of my, you know, from the kitchen to hook up the telephone and, you know, everything to try and preserve all of this stuff that we were getting, all of this information. And so Reverend Ed Beck, Jim, but one of the real big ones that really started to push this was Arlene Martell.
And who
is Arlene? She was beautiful inside and out. She was just she was just so happy to participate. However, she hold was
on. For people hesitant. Who don't know who she is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For those, for instance, who may not have watched Hogan's Heroes, Arlene Martell played Tiger. She was a member of the Underground. She was a love interest of Colonel Hogan. And separate from that, Erica, you may or may not
the women
watch
love
Star
interests.
Trek. She played Spock's wife.
Okay. Okay.
In Star Trek and a million other things. She was known as the Chameleon.
Yes.
And she could do any accent. She could play any role. She was just a tremendous woman. And she was the first, I think she was the first real recorded interview we did, isn't she?
She was our
we ended
first
up on the phone
with
her for 2 or 3 hours.
And yeah, it did. And then we had her back a second time too, for some clarification on points. But what the big thing with her was she wanted an agreement, because again, these folks had been burned and they're used to agreements, yeah. But they also did not want to be misrepresented. And so I work for a publishing firm and I've been there for over going on 25 years now. And we do contracts all the time for authors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, agree to write this chapter, transfer of copyright, that kind of thing. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, this goes back to 2006, this is before we have like the cloud and we can access our files and, you know, pre-COVID where, you know, everything is remote. It's at 4 o'clock in the morning. She wants to do this interview. I'm driving over to the office and I'm going, okay, I've got to figure out how I can make this contract that I'm using for this publication over here for nurses be an agreement to be interviewed. And so that's what I did. I just kind of reworked it and said, okay, you know, instead of, you know, writing a chapter, you're being interviewed. And, it, you know, we promised them a copy of the book. We promised them that they could see their page proofs so that they could review just their sections to make sure that we were, you know, quoting them properly and that we weren't misrepresenting them. And as it turned out, there were about 10 people that actually said they wanted to do that. And they signed the agreements. Arlene never did. Like, that was enough for her. Just
I was going to say, she never ended up doing that in the end.
No, she never
ended up doing it. And she started going to other people.
Yes.
For us. I think she kept going to Robert Clary.
Yeah. So she would go to other people for us and she would be like, you have to talk to these girls. You have to talk to them because they're doing good work. And some of them came our way and some of them, you know, you can't force somebody to talk. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them from Hogan's Heroes came on board because Arlene was the first one to really trust us. I am in this mm-hmm. with you. I want to set this right. I want to tell Bob's story. Linda, you can tell the Al Ruddy story if you want, but I want to tell my Arlene story. I want to tell my Arlene story first, because this is a funny story.
The Al Ruddy story.
Yeah, you can have your Al Ruddy story. I'm gonna tell the Arlene story.
Do you know who Al Ruddy? I'll tell you who Al Ruddy is in case your listeners don't know who mm-hmm. Al Ruddy is. Al Ruddy was one of the original two creators of Hogan's Heroes. Al Ruddy also became the executive producer, but the producer of The Godfather.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So he went on to do
Baby as well.
Million Dollar
Baby.
Big things. Yeah.
Yeah. Big things. And he started by being this guy who wanted to write a comedy with Bernie Fine. He became huge in Hollywood, but he didn't want to stay in television. He wanted to make movies. But he created Hogan's Heroes. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to talk to him to find out whether he had any direct connection with Bob. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't, at the very least, what I wanted to know was, did Bob encapsulate what he expected of Colonel Hogan? Mm-hmm. Because even though he sold the rights to the show very quickly, he did write, you know, when you sell a show, you have to have some plots in the can. You can't just go, here's a show. We don't have any stories for you, but here's the setup. Mm-hmm, so right. They wrote, if you watch the episodes, he's not actually credited as writing them, but when you look it up in IMDb later on, he did become credited with some of the writing in the first season, because that's how those stories began. So I emailed off to Al Ruddy's office because there was a lot of work. A lot of the work Carol and I did was about finding people. You couldn't just email people. You had to write to these people. So how do we find them? And, you know, we did find an email for Al Ruddy's office in Los Angeles. He was a working producer. So of course he did have some, you know, public access in that way. So I emailed his office with my formal, you know, my name is Linda Groundwater and I am doing this. And we had our whole spiel down by the time we got him, and that was 2007. Mm-hmm. And we'd been doing it for about 4 or 5 years since then. So we knew what to do. And here's my list of people who we've already spoken with. And could you please talk to me? And I got a very nice email back from his secretary a couple of days later, which was surprising, because usually if they don't want to speak to you, someone will just ignore you.
Yes.
they just ignore you, yeah. Especially those big people. You just don't hear from them. Thank you very much. Right. No, thank you. Even get an answer.
Yeah. We know. We've been ignored.
Yes. You can be ignored, and you're being ignored by the best, you know.
But right. You don't know if you don't try. I'm sure you know all of this a little too well. If you don't know, if you don't try, you'll strike out. If you don't try, so at least
don't ask, don't get at the first bat.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I got this email back that said, look, thank you very much. Mr. Ruddy would like you to know that he appreciates your interest, but he didn't have any direct connection with Bob, and so he doesn't feel he would have anything to contribute. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that email and I thought, okay, and I said, thank you so much for responding, I appreciate it. I said, my questions really were more to the idea of how Bob became Colonel Hogan and whether that was within Mr. Ruddy's, you know, purview, whether that's what whether that was in his vision of the character and whatnot. But I appreciate it. If he ever decides that he has, you know, changes his mind or has anything to contribute, please hold on to my contact details and we'd be happy to discuss it with him. And I thought that was the end of it. That was just a nice, thanks very much, and I'm going away now. And 2 days later, it was 7:45 in the morning and the phone rang in my house, and I walked past the phone and I said, it's Kane. I'm not picking it up. My husband picked up the phone and a few seconds later comes in and he holds the phone out to me and he says, Al Ruddy. And I said, and he said, Al Ruddy. And I said, what about him? And he's like, he's on the phone.
Wow.
And I just was like, I said, do you know who that is? And he said, nope. I said, I know who that is. He said, there's a lady on the phone. So, I mean, Al Ruddy was big enough, he didn't even make his own calls.
Oh, no, of course not.
Hi, this is so-and-so.
No.
Mr. Ruddy, you know, and he got your email and he'd like to talk to you. I said, okay. So he got on the phone and I'm here sweating bullets. And
what I love is that you were probably really prepared, and then when the phone call came in, you went blank.
So I said, all right. So he got on the phone and I said, thank you so much. I said, look, can you give me a little bit of time? I said, I just have to organize to get my son to school and to call my job and tell them I'm going to be late. Because go to school. I said, yeah. He said, where are you? And I said, I'm in Brisbane, Australia. And he said, oh my God, take all the time you want.
And then
I called Carol.
I get this frantic voicemail. I was packing to go on a trip for work. And I get this frantic voicemail. Carol. Already. Carol.
Yeah, and you didn't
sound like
up,
our story, you know? Lucy, about when I got Keith on the phone. And I called her friend. I'll tell you later, but go on.
That story.
Yeah. Oh, no. I said, you know, one of the surviving I Love Lucy characters, Keith Thibodeau. And I had placed an email, a couple of emails, because I'm relentless. And and a couple of calls and left a voicemail and all of the things. And he probably was like, okay, this she really wants to talk. I need to see what this is about.
So I'm just, I mean, this is when we first started recording. Yeah, we were too. The podcast was brand new.
I mean, yeah. And so I get a phone call just randomly. I was like, what? I think I forget what state he's in. Oh my gosh. And I hardly ever pick up states that I don't recognize. Right. Said, hello. He says, Erica, this is Keith Thibodeau. I'm sorry. What? This is who?
What? Who is this?
Sir?
And I don't expect to hear from them that you have issues.
It was a random Tuesday. And then, you know, just, hello, sir. And everything I wanted to say.
What?
And I called her and I did the Carol, Carol, Carol thing to Lucy. Kind of like, you're not going to believe. I don't care what, you know, appointments you have or, you know, ignore your kid. We need to do this.
Ignore your kid. Yep.
But yeah,
you don't know. You don't expect it. And, you know, Al turned out to be one of my favorite interviews of all the interviews that we did.
That's amazing.
He was so funny and he was
so personable. I mean, just very, he just, it was not a long interview because he truly didn't know Bob very well. No. He could only speak to Bob's place in Hogan's Heroes.
Which is what we wanted from him in the end.
That's right. Know? But the 45 minutes that we did spend on the phone with him are brilliant. And
my favorite.
It's a high. It for sure is.
That's a great memory to have too, to put it in this book. And when you were doing now the research for his first couple of jobs and what was happening, you know, his marriage was brand new at the time too, and probably not starting off well, I imagine, just based on the timeline that we have. How did you immerse yourself in that part of his life? How did you get that information?
So Bob's marriage to Anne is number one. I just want to say it's, you know, marriages are complicated, I think, no matter who you are. And Bob and Anne got married at a very early age. They were dating since he was 14 and she was I mean, they were high, 14, they were high 16 school, childhood years old.
Before childhood. That's a big commitment to be like, then I'm going to marry you.
Yes. Oh, they were together.
Yeah.
They were together all through high school. You know, she even joined the band because Bob was in the band.
She played the Glockenspiel.
So, number one, yes, their marriage did have ups and downs, but even after they divorced in 1970, and I'm jumping ahead, but even so, they had children together and they still had love for each other. When Anne found out that Bob had been murdered, she was a wreck. She was completely, she just wailed. Marriages are complicated. And yes, they had separated on and off throughout their early life in Connecticut. I do think they looked at California as a fresh start. I do believe that. Getting into Bob's early life took a lot of work. A lot of that came from Jim, of course, because Jim, being a family member and a cousin, he saw a lot of that early life. So we were able to, you know, hear those early stories from Jim about the family, about going to Waterbury, and about, you know, all of those different pieces of the Crane and the Senich family, both sides.
And Jim was so lovely, because when I went back to the States, I've gone back a few times, not as often as I'd like, but I've gone back a few times. But the last time I went, I actually spent a couple of days with Jim and his wife, Ellen, and my heart just stays with him. He was just the best of among the best of the Senich.
As much as you were discussing, he became your world, Bob Crane, when you're writing this book, I imagine. Yes. And when you're having these conversations, lunches, dinners, whatever, or just, you know, chats with these people, it must feel like you're speaking of an old friend that you of course didn't meet, but you know so much of him, and someone who actually knew him, it must have been something else to feel.
It was.
Yeah, and we became very close to some of these people, and so many of them are so much older now that, you know, unfortunately, we've lost a fair few of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them to whom we were quite close, and some that we were just very grateful to have had the chance to pass by. But when you think about it, we were, except for some family, and I would argue probably even some family, even that, we would be the only people who have such a full picture of him. We don't have as intimate a picture of him, but family know of family things, and work people know of work people things, of work things. Mm-hmm. And there will be some crossover, but
don't always have that. Yeah.
Yeah. It'll be rare to have all those different layers, so that each time, and that's not to diminish any of those people, because that's the natural movement of life. You know, my husband doesn't know everything about everybody I work with. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody I work with doesn't know about everything that happens in my personal life. But when you're a biographer, you end up knowing a bit of everything, and a lot of everything if you do it right. And so each time a new person came in, they would tell us their part of the story and how that slotted in to their part of the story. And we would then somehow take that part and fit it in with all the other things that we knew, which then allow us to give a bigger picture. But we tried really hard, and I think Carol will be the first to agree here, never to judge any of the things that we were told, never to say that couldn't be because of this, especially because each person is such a and Bob is a perfect example, but no more a perfect example than anyone else, that we are all a bundle of contradictions.
Also, and it's you know, I've spent countless time, countless hours, countless days in Connecticut. I've spent tons of time in Stamford, Connecticut. You know, Waterbury is where he was born, but it's yes, where the roots are, but not for Bob's growing up years, not for Bob's friends, not for where he worked. I've spent so much time with Bob's friends. I was invited to his high school reunion, his 65th high school reunion, as their special guest. I became very, very, very dear friends with Charlie Zito, and that is who the book is dedicated to. Charlie was Bob's best friend. His best lifelong friend. When people say, oh, John Carpenter was Bob's best friend, he was not. He was a hanger-on. He was the person who was in the room, you know, in who was at the end of his
there. Life.
He was, was there, but the people who were Bob's best friends, it was his high school friends. It was his, they were his people. And then, you know, when he moved out west, yes, he made some friends there as well. Pam and Johnny Thompson were considered his best friends, but his lifelong best friend was Charlie. I spent countless time with Charlie. You know, these people became part of our lives as much as we became part of theirs. And so when that began to happen, we didn't know that was going to happen. It wasn't like, oh, let's infiltrate Bob's
let's circle. Let's become part of this world.
It didn't start that way. But what we also came to realize was that Bob surrounded himself. Yes. When he was engaging in his sexual proclivities, and when that became the addiction, there were some very, you know, not so upstanding characters that he associated with in that circle. But the bulk of his life, where he surrounded himself with some of the most beautiful people I have ever had the privilege and the honor to not only just know and communicate with, but to embrace as part of my own life. There's Charlie Zito. There is
Morgan
Gordon. There is Morgan Kaolian from WICC. You know, both Charlie and Morgan have now since passed. I would go up. Morgan was a pilot, and when I would go up to visit, and Dee's in Connecticut, so Dee is actually part of that. So, like, even though she is part she's a co-author on the book. Without Dee, we would not have gotten as much as we had gotten with WICC because she was WICC. She worked there for 40 years.
Right. Well, I started talking to Al Warren, and Al gave me to Dee, and Dee got me to all those other people. And then when you came on, of course, she was already plugging away. So Dee's been long and
Dee and I became
ingrained part of that whole story.
Yes. Dee, and when I would go to Connecticut, I would just stay with Dee. Dee and I are like, you know, we're like two peas in a pod. And so we would go and we would research all of Connecticut. We would go, you know, the part about the Connecticut Symphony Orchestra, where it was, you know, did Bob really get kicked out? You know,
or did he?
You know, Bob always said he was hired by Connecticut Symphony Orchestra and then he got fired for messing around on the timpani and whatever. We learned, we really dug. We went through the Connecticut Symphony archives. And what we learned was that Bob was never actually officially hired. It was all the student program. And that was something that, you know, nobody ever had gotten that before. Yeah. And so, you know, we spent hours with Connecticut Symphony Orchestra just going through all of their files.
Well, and getting all the National Guard records. I got hold of the National Guard records and things, and, you know, things that people never bothered to get. That's how I learned what his resting pulse was. How tall he was and what. You know, you picture this big, tall, skinny high school kid, and there's his fingerprints.
Right.
There's his whole life at that moment. Because one of the things you talked about was, and you just mentioned it in brief about joining the Army. He didn't join the Army. Bob joined the National Guard. Yes. And he said it was part of the typewriter, the Remington Brigade. Remington Raiders, because they use the Remington typewriters. But it was very important. And Bob was very patriotic. Conservative, Republican, Connecticut, patriotic, did patriotic films, U.S. Armed Forces Radio, did promo spots for the service, did them in costume as Colonel Hogan, but also did them later on. Bob was always about supporting the country, said the best, he said, remind me of the quote, Carol, but he said, I need to do this for my country. It's the least I can do for what they've done for me.
And so when he first started, starting to form the star that he became, starting from KNX and working his way up to TV spots, and then eventually onto the role that, you know, catapulted him. Do you think, just by the way you've spoken to people, that, of course it changes, as fame, I think, would change any of us, but did that change who he was as a person? Did the character, did the soul?
No. They're both change. Saying no. As you're asking this question, they're both like, no.
Well, the thing is, though, isn't it, Carol, that the story, the better story, so to speak, is that Hollywood turned Bob into a bad guy. And we know that Bob wasn't a bad guy. We know that he was a guy who had an addiction. But Hollywood, aside from the fact that there were trappings there, it didn't change him. And as a matter of fact, it annoyed him sometimes, because I remember Jim telling me a story, Jim Senich, his cousin, saying, I have to put an electric fence around my yard because to protect my kids. And he hated that.
He also hated the whole idea that people saw him only as Colonel Hogan.
Yeah, and I think he touched on that on our podcast.
An actor wants to act. And so when he gets his role as Colonel Hogan, he embraces it and he goes for it and he gives it his all. Bob was driven. He got very annoyed and frustrated because people thought he wasn't acting. But he was acting. He was working very, very hard at the role of
Colonel Hogan. Yeah, and
exactly.
So, you know, when he didn't win the Emmys, the rumor mill was that, well, you're just being yourself. You didn't really have to work for that.
Yeah.
And that really bothered him because he said, I do work hard. So he does the role for 6 years. The Hogan's Heroes was supposed to go for 7 seasons. It ended after the 6th season because of the rural purge from CBS. But after that, he finds himself terribly typecast, in which we talked to directors of like Ellery Queen and some of the things that he had done in that span of 1971 through about 1977. So in there you've got the Bob Crane show on NBC, you've got different things happening. And Linda's making a face because the Bob Crane show, that's a whole like
that chapter hurts me. We're not going to talk about that today.
But that chapter
of the book hurts me. Mm-hmm. That hurts me. That hurt to write. It hurt to read.
But what Bob was finding was that directors were hiring him, and he was getting cast in some of these guest starring roles, but it was almost like they were hiring Colonel Hogan. So
yeah,
and even the casting directors and the directors of the episodes of these shows could not get past the typecasting. Bob was standing, I don't know if it was the Queen Mary or whatever, but he was standing on board a ship looking down at some of the people there, and he was just standing up there. People were hey, look, it's Colonel Hogan, and somebody had overheard him say, my name's Bob Crane, damn it, because as much as he loved Colonel Hogan and being Colonel Hogan, it was a job, and it wasn't
right. That's not who he is.
What's interesting is we also did a story on the death of George Reeve, a podcast on that, and also when we speak of Lucille Ball, these two huge actors also suffered in that where George Reeves hated to be typecast as always being Superman.
You see that even now, and I don't know if you watch The Big Bang Theory.
Yep.
But Jim Parsons is now trying to break out of that of Sheldon
that,
character.
That role.
That Sheldon character is really hard. That would be very hard
to break forward from. Right?
Mm-hmm. Because
the Disney characters that trying to go from the cutesy sweet and let me go to an extreme and play a killer or something.
Right.
Like
that's, I mean, we kind of see, Miley Cyrus, like people are wondering why she went so
wild,
psycho and wild,
out of that.
She had to break from what she was. Mm-hmm. Right.
Sure.
And I mean, and Bob Crane had not only the typecasting, but the addiction. And I think that, when we're looking at it and what I kind of wanted to like push and that I hoped I pushed in the episode was that people have addictions and that's not at all who they are.
Listening
to your podcast, I was very pleased to hear the way you both had more of an understanding of addiction in terms of you can be addicted to anything. You don't just have to be addicted to heroin or cocaine or drugs or alcohol or whatever. There are other kinds of addiction. And I can't remember, was it you, Erica, who said, it's not just an excuse to cheat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that it's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that comes from when you hear people like Tiger Woods, Pete Rose going, oh, he's a sex addict. Or David Duchovny, I think, went away for a weekend to take care of his sex addiction. Then it's not an addiction. If all it takes is a weekend and a zipper, then you don't have an addiction. Mm-hmm.
It's something that you struggle with the minute you wake up to the second you go to sleep.
Correct. Even if it's not conscious, that struggle is there all the time. And for Bob, there's no place that you can point a finger and say that began your addiction. Right here is where your addiction began. The first time you did
it evolved.
It evolves over time. And Bob long struggled. I mean, we went back to think of Tutti Di Benedetto. Telling us, Carol, about throw names out that other people won't know. was somebody that Bob knew way back when
we were
talking about the bands
back in Connecticut.
He said, Bob, turn your head the other way, and he said, you could put a paper bag over that woman's head, and he would still be interested.
Yeah. And if you guys want to know these names, read the book.
Beck is the one who said to us that a sexual addiction is one of the hardest addictions to overcome, harder than some of the hardest drugs,
because it's all up here, it's in here.
all the time. It's always available.
And it's a physical addiction as well, because your body gets used to a certain high, and the more sex you have, I'm sorry, I don't know if this is past your PG, but the more sex you have, you edit away, the less, you know, the harder it is to get that same response.
Well, it's
quite literally available too. That's really the other thing.
It's quite literally
the
definition of addiction.
You know, if you are struggling with an addiction to alcohol and you are in a treatment program, you avoid buying liquor and you avoid going to bars and you avoid having it around you. If you are, trying to overcome a drug addiction, you don't have the drugs around you. Mm-hmm. But for a sexual addiction, and in Bob's case, it was with women. You go out your front door.
You don't
door,
have women around?
And there's women all around. You can't lock yourself in a room.
Unless you're in a monastery, there's going to be women around somewhere.
If you didn't become a monk, there you go.
There you go.
The
issue is, too, a man, a regular 9-to-5 man who has a sex addiction, he has to go out and maybe meet a woman here and there. This is like flies to honey when you are a star him, and like most of males in Hollywood, you could from a starter band to a Aerosmith, you have fans and women or men or anybody will just naturally gravitate towards you because of the allure, and plus you have somebody who is, for lack of a better word, sick inside, battling with something. It's just it's a whole recipe for what
it
ended
is.
Up happening.
It
in
is.
His
but
life.
You have so to
you have to think too is that Bob is also held to a different standard because he was found murdered, and then all of this came out, and everybody had a field day with it. Mm-hmm. Look around you at Hollywood, and you know, without naming any names, it's Bob is just held to a different standard.
Yes.
There is a lot more of it going on.
Oh, yes.
And some of it people realize, and some of it people don't realize, but it goes on all the time.
I mean,
in Hollywood and
in
any industry.
It was going on, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But he was a star character. And I mean, we see this nowadays, you know, where things that, you know, divorce or an affair or things that you would be like, you know, that's happened in my life, or I've known someone that's happened in their life, and it's not nearly that big.
That is
right.
Yeah, of course.
But all of a sudden it's a celebrity, and boom, it's like massive news. And so you think an addiction, people deal with addiction all the time, but you think, okay, this is a star.
Yeah. We get to deal with it privately.
Let's see how
in our
we
home.
Get right.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
get to
sad,
deal
the
with
sad
it privately.
About,
he is all of a sudden it's very public. Mm-hmm. Very
the sad
out
thing
there.
About Bob is that he had it in him to want to change. He
was trying to change at
he
the
was
time
trying
that
to change.
Passed. Yeah.
He wrote, he approached, he actually didn't approach Reverend Beck right away. He actually approached somebody else affiliated with the theater, because at that time, all Reverend Beck was to Bob was Ed Beck. It was not, oh, Reverend Beck, who's a counselor in any kind of addiction. It was Ed Beck who opened the theater each night and signed the paycheck. Oh, but this was all part of a bigger program within the church that Ed Beck was affiliated with, the United Church of Christ, that was doing this outreach program to these theaters where actors and actresses were going on the road. And they were kind of placing their clergy into these places that if an actor who had been on the road and was looking to talk to somebody about some sort of issue or problem that they were dealing with, they would then make themselves available. They wouldn't put themselves in their face. They would just naturally be available. So a lot of people didn't even know that he was a reverend or that he was with the clergy or with a church or was an addiction counselor. And so when Bob was looking to find help taking those first initial baby steps, it was who he went to, somebody with the theater that he felt he could trust. And he said, who can I talk to? I'm looking to find
better himself.
You know, better myself and find my way out of this lifestyle that is starting to consume me. And he did acknowledge it to Reverend Beck as an addiction. And the guy said, talk to Ed Beck. And he goes, Ed Beck, why? And he said, because, and he said, you know, he's a counselor and he's a minister and he can help you. And so that's when Bob in Scottsdale started to, and you know, talk to Reverend Beck and explain what he was going through. Now, Reverend Beck was not an expert in this type of addiction. And so that is where he was coaching Bob in those early, in that very early stage, and asking him some questions and saying, asking him how serious he was about all of this. And Bob said he was very serious about it. And so what was supposed to happen is that Bob was going to get home from Scottsdale and go to the psychologist who Reverend Beck had, you know,
lined up for him,
for him. And they were going to start this very, very heavy work. And part of that therapy was going to be to destroy the films.
So if I may
I just think start we discussed that. This, didn't we?
Oh yeah, to a little extent. Bit. Yeah. So if I could just start that topic of the codependent relationship that he then eventually developed with John Carpenter, because that's what that's how it came across to me. It was kind of like, I need you for this, I need you for this, and we both have something that's going to eventually ruin us, and so. That relationship, I know we could probably spend hours on what it really encompassed, but just in a nutshell, what do you think was the attraction other than the equipment, the, you know, the digital equipment for him?
By digital, yeah.
Not as much as you've been led to believe, okay. I think is probably the better way of putting it. As Schrader said, and as others have told us, Carpenter was creepy. Mm-hmm. And he I've was not that
from the look.
Yeah. And people that interviewed encountered him said that he was creepy. He was not the kind of person that Bob would normally hang around with. And Bob didn't actually need him. Okay. He became a hanger-on. They were introduced originally by Richard Dawson way back in the day, because they both, Bob and Dickie, were interested in electronics. Bob was always videotaping. That was something that you guys also both touched on, which was terrific, because you could see that, you know, I mean, they discussed, you know, reams and reams of, you know, miles of tape and thing that
so much Bob part, would larger Bob would part set of a tape his recorder, life, right?
Yeah, yeah, well, every part of his life. Bob would set a tape recorder running at the dinner table.
Yeah,
yep.
You know, and
people
and
didn't just know about that part.
No,
you know,
they didn't, because that wasn't the interesting part, the
scandalous part. But like,
yep, really, that wasn't the interesting part. So, but Richard Dawson and Bob were both interested in electronics and keeping, you know, what in the 60s and early 70s, this is all new stuff. You know, Betamax and VCRs and all these neat things. And because John Carpenter was a Sony rep, he was able to come and say, here's what I have. But I think it was Scotty, Bob's second son, Scott, who actually said to us, makes you realize when someone else says it, it's actually quite logical, but you don't think of it until somebody says it to you. He said, he didn't need him. If you go back to his radio times and even all the things he was doing at home, Bob didn't need anyone to set up equipment for him. Bob set up his own studio. Bob designed his own equipment and designed his own setup for radio when he was at KNX and at ICC and at LIZ, had studios at home that he was in. He didn't need.
He was a wingman. Let's face it. He was a wingman who was in on this type of lifestyle. I mean, it's important to also say that, you know, Bob did not force women. It was all consensual. And you guys had touched on this as well. Yes. It was all consensual. The women were willing participants. The cameras were this big. There was no hiding it.
They knew they were there. Yep. Mm-hmm.
But it was also something that his friends from high school and his friends from, you know, other aspects of his life, he didn't want them to know. He didn't really, you know, go into that. So when he did die and all this came out, it was, oh, wow, we knew he was kind of a ladies man, but holy cow, we never knew.
We
that.
Didn't know it was this bad, it this was far. This
at all. Like, yeah, not at all. Yeah. Very few of them knew.
Right.
Very exactly. few of them. So, and that other part, Carol, where, you know, was it was Gary Owen, God bless Gary Owen, from Laugh-In.
And the letter E. Street.
Mm-hmm. The first thing he said to us, and so many of them said it, but for some reason his really stuck out in my mind. Mm-hmm. Because Gary Owen was lovely, and his voice stayed absolutely Imagine speaking to the voice of Sesame Street at 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh my God. Brought to you by your POV. You
know, that's a certain kind of dream.
It was fun doing some of these, but terrifying because you could be a fan as well as a journalist, and you have to focus on being a journalist while inside you're going, oh my God.
That was us. We were just beginning the podcast and we were like, are we being professional?
Keep your professionalism in, you know, we're fine. But Gary Owen, one of the first things he said when we got on the phone, he said, I'm so happy to be able to talk to you about Bob Crane. He said, but I am not going to talk about
that.
Mm. And that's all he called it, that. Huh. And we said, well, good, because I'm not here to talk to you about that. And the longer you speak to someone, very few, I should say, maybe 2 out of 200 of the conversations were short. Mm-hmm. We spoke to everybody for a good hour, mm-hmm. you know,
or more.
I remember hanging laundry talking to Tootie. They learn to trust you. They're hearing from the questions that you're asking, the kinds mm-hmm. of things you actually want to know, so that at some stage, I actually said to Gary Owen, you don't need to tell me about that. I said, all I want to know is, were you aware of that? Mm-hmm. And almost to a person, they said, no.
Nope.
And these are people that were with Bob on a regular basis.
Which shows you how much he wanted to keep that part of him private.
Absolutely. He was not proud of it. Right. He was proud of that. He was not proud of that. Mm-hmm. He might come across as being proud of that, you know, because you don't go out and meet women by going, hi, would you like to spend some time with me?
Yeah.
Let me talk to you. You know, that doesn't happen. You go out and you seem proud and you seem confident.
Right.
But Bob was not proud and confident about that aspect of his life. He did like sex. He was the first to admit that he liked sex, but that he was not proud of his addiction. He was not proud of what it did to his family. He was not proud of how it destroyed his marriages. He was very aware that he had a problem. And
it was making he was also very concerned that because of this, he was not being a good father to his children.
Absolutely. And so that was aware the driving that he force. This.
Yeah.
Right. We discussed this that like at the very end, and this is what's so rough and what's so hard, is that at the end he was making those moves. He was talking to the reverend. He was like, this is where I'm at. I accept. You know, when you're thinking about the road to recovery, acceptance is the first step, right? And he was there.
Yes, he was there.
He's like, I accept this is what I'm what's happening. I'm hoping to make things right with my family,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be there as a father. And he was making those steps. And I think that what's so rough is that people don't see that, right?
No.
And we hear this story. And I think that's what's so great about your book is that people see this story and they just move past the acceptance mm-hmm. and they just see the scandal of it all, the addiction of it all. And you forget that, like, at the base, really, at any addiction, is that there's just a human being there.
That's struggling.
Right.
That's struggling and wanting to help. And he was right there. He was working. He was hopeful. Mm-hmm. You know, from what I got from the book, he was
always hopeful.
He was excited. From that chat that he had with
the reporter.
Remind me of the name of right before he passed away.
The last fellow he spoke to, he said he's the man who always sees the pony in the next room.
Oh, no.
Came to see him, his wife and his son. Right.
Oh, yes. Patty and Bob.
Yeah, yeah. And he was Scotty. Excited. He was planning to make things thrilled. Better. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this as like a good thing, right? Like as a positive step forward. And he was mm-hmm. planning on all these good things that he was gonna get this help. And I think that people just pass through this and they just go like, he's a sex addict.
Someone said to me once,
and that's why I love this book, and that's why I'm like, read the book, you know, if you want to really know who the
person
is.
Someone said to me once, and it really stuck with me, because it's so easy to judge an addict, any kind of addict, any kind of addicts, drugs, sex, rock and roll, whatever, you know, any kind of addiction, alcohol, is they go, oh, but, you know, he's an addict, what a weak person. It's like, but you know what? I don't know a single person who can say that when they were a small child and someone said, what do you want to be when you grow up? That they said, oh, let me be an addict. Let me have something that controls my life that I have no control over, that will ruin and invade every aspect of my life. No one does that.
You're a prisoner to it, essentially.
Yeah.
And so
it's taken you. Bob didn't say, oh gosh, sex. Well, that'll be the one. Let me go and have that. And I've had, you know, and you hear the jokes. You hear people say, well, if there's going to be an addiction, that's the kind I want. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's like, no, you don't want any addiction.
You don't want any addiction.
And this is a very hard, this was a very, very hard addiction. And
so
it was
going through that time, if I may take you over to Scottsdale, then to the windmill dinner theater and the time where he was doing is beginner's luck. And if I'm correct, it's during that time of his life, he was either separating or going through that with his second wife, correct?
He had been separated from his second wife. She had served him with divorce papers and he was very unhappy.
Right. And so, and that was also, that was when he's going through attempting to, and also journaled the other breakup, which was with John Carpenter, which you really,
document diarize the breakup per se, but you just never see him again.
He drops off of, like, and you said this in the
he
book,
just drops
like,
off
he
the
was
radar,
there and he but- wasn't there.
Yeah,
right?
Like, but having said that, I will say the one odd thing, well, it's not odd, but the one thing about that is that if something wasn't going to happen, or sorry, if something was going to happen and then wasn't going to happen, Bob wouldn't erase it.
He would cross it off.
Cross it off. Yeah. And so, you know, they had Scott told me at one point that there was an entry for, you know, dentist 2 o'clock. And if it didn't happen, he would cross it off and say, dentist rescheduled. You know, doctor had to do such and such a thing, appointment now on this date. And if you go to the other date and the dental appointment is there, you now know everything that happened in the dental appointment. And, you know, that's an obsession all on its own. Sure. But the fact that they say, you know, John Carpenter didn't appear anymore in the diary, to me, doesn't indicate that he was cutting him out. It indicates that he just didn't have any plans with him at that time. Otherwise, it would have been crossed out and noted.
And the other thing too is that where they say it was his name was crossed off on that day, it's not crossed off.
No, it's not.
It said take him to airport, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
But it's not crossed off. It's not like scribbled out and like you know.
So I will correct one thing, and I know you used many sources, so I suspect this might have come from John Hook. But
that was mainly a lot of the one that I used.
This might have come from John Hook, but Carpenter did not stay with Bob.
Oh no! He put him down. I think it was.
Just there. There was a comment saying he usually stayed with Bob, but in this case he sent him somewhere else.
Right.
He did not. They did not. So Bob did not want. But each guy wanted their own spot.
And not only that, but
wherever
you have to remember,
Carpenter appeared, he was staying someplace else.
You have to remember that he's on the road for a show.
Yes.
And so the theater company is putting him up in the nice posh,
right?
You know, the nicer apartment or the nicer place for the star. He is the star of that particular production.
Right.
Well, yeah.
The rest of the cast don't even stay in that same. So the rest of the cast weren't even staying at
which is why is it Victoria Barry?
Yes.
She was elsewhere and she's the one that came to find him.
He didn't show up for lunch. Yeah. He didn't show up for lunch and she said he never missed anything. Never missed anything. So she went to look for him. Yeah.
So what is your theory? Of course, everyone has one.
Everyone has a theory.
We laugh at them both laughing. We get asked this all the time.
This is what we came for.
I think Carol's
Carol's
like, if I had a dollar, I would have retired years ago.
You would be millionaires at this point.
There are many, many, many theories. Linda and I have ours. Because how would we not?
Everyone has this, right?
Of course. However, that is all they are theories. Without evidence, then we're really no better than people judging Bob without having all of the facts. And so to elaborate on a theory, that we don't have evidence on, we could be absolutely 100% right, or we could be absolutely 100% wrong. But if we say it and we're wrong, then we could be damage
someone else's reputation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And which, so I will you tell know, you that I don't think it was Carpenter.
And I agree with that.
Cool. Hold on. You just added another hour.
He was convenient. He was creepy. But,
he was not smart enough.
Now, I wonder, yeah. I don't know if you ladies remember at the end of our, you know, the podcast was us hitting on this, of course, as everyone's circumstantial comes back to that because it's easy and it makes sense and all the things. But I did hit on a couple of things, and I wonder if you ladies agree to that, is, of course, guessing and theories all over the place, is a jealous lover, a jealous husband of a lover, the wife or soon to be ex-wife.
What I will say is mm-hmm. that if you look at the nature of the crime, mm-hmm. it is very violent.
Oh, yes.
It is very intimate. Personal. And is very personal.
Yes. Very, yes. very personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone was it very seems angry. Like a, the person a grudge who, lover. Yes.
The well, the person
you won't
who,
say, but
the person who murdered Bob didn't just murder him with a shotgun or a knife.
It's they very intimate. Hit
him twice over the head, as if almost to blot out his entire mind, his entire existence.
So I wonder if you're putting down sort of what I heard when on the Phoenix 10 mm-hmm. station when they did the DNA testing and it turned mm-hmm. out that it wasn't John Carpenter, and you would think it'd be like, hurrah, here we are, we've exonerated him, and you have
it was Al Capone's vault.
Yeah, it was really a waste of time. It was really
so the son is like, that's
Bobby, who, by the way, was not Bobby Jr. We will say was not. He made himself Bobby Jr. Mm-hmm. There was no Jr.
Because there was two names.
But there were three David. Roberts. Okay. There was Robert right. Edward, who was dad. Right. There was Robert Scott, who was the second son. And right. there was Robert David, who was okay. the first son. So there was never a Jr.
Okay.
But at mm-hmm. some stage, Bobby decided that he needed
I'll be
to
the
be
Jr.
Jr. Yeah.
He needed okay. to be the Jr.
He needed to be Jr. So he made himself Junior.
Okay.
And that's his choice. I got nothing to do with it. But if you're looking at real reality, there is no Bob Crane Junior. There is mm-hmm. just Robert David, Robert Scott, Robert Edward. That's
I
it.
See.
You can't be mm-hmm. a Junior.
Strange
if your
to have
the
three
same.
Roberts.
Period. but yes, Bob did tell his friend that the reason he named them all that was that he liked that name.
The name. Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
The name.
Like, okay. There are other theories around that about naming things after fathers and father-in-laws or whatnot. But the kids went by, you know, Bobby went by Bobby. So the first son went by Bobby. Yeah. Second one went by Scott. Oh. You know, Scotty. But yeah, when the Carol and I actually talked about this before we came on, because we knew that, you know, the whole John Hook thing with the DNA did come mm-hmm. up, and we totally get that. Like, it was a big nothing burger, to use right. the vernacular yes. of the time. There was nothing there, and part of it's because, you know, far out, you know, they lost bits. It was 15 years old,
right?
It could have been anybody. That it wasn't Bob, and that was all that mattered. And then, of course, Bobby, the first thing Bobby did was go, well, that was Patty,
right?
Well, there's a few things happening there. One is that Patty was in another state, and they have evidence that she was in another state. Two, she could have gotten someone else, but then it wouldn't have been Patty. And there's never been any indication that she could have organized or coordinated with anyone else, and anyone else doing it wouldn't have made it for her, would not have made it as personal. If she said to somebody, go off and kill my husband, they're not going to go do what this murderer did.
Because they're not that invested in it.
Done. That's right.
Right.
And to be fair, to both sides here, there was not a lot of love lost between Patty and Scotty and Bobby. If you look at Bob's gravestone, you will see that Bobby is missing from the list of children. That is because Patty does not want him there. If somebody's going to not be Bob's son, you accused my son of not being Bob's son. Oh, you are not right. Bob's son. Mm-hmm. We're taking you out.
That's right.
You know, and to that also came, by the way, and I find this interesting because you mentioned it and there's more to the story. So all we want to do here is add to that story, mm-hmm. Where Bobby started this. Scotty can't be Bob's son because Bob had a vasectomy.
Right.
Have you looked at Scotty? Have you ever seen Scotty?
Is that the spinning image?
Scotty is his father's twin.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. He could play him in a movie.
He's an actor. You can look him up.
Okay.
Scotty mm-hmm. looks so much like his father.
Right.
That mm-hmm. you could not in any reasonable thought process say that Scott is not Bob Crane's son.
So it is what we.
Bob did have a vasectomy. Yeah. It failed.
But they don't always work.
Yeah, they don't always work. Yes.
You know, it failed. They fail. And
especially with medical advances not being as advanced as we are.
I just looked them up. I just looked them up.
Yeah. Now look at Scotty and look at Bob.
Got like a side to side.
You are the father type of a.
Oh, yeah. Like, you can't deny, right? You can't deny that.
You absolutely cannot deny that Scott looks like Bob. And so what happened was. I mean, when Johnny Thompson, who worked with Bob and was a very good friend of Bob, and he was a magician, and he and his wife, Pam, were in Vegas and very close to Bob. And Johnny and Bob went off to Japan and had twin vasectomies.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Lovely.
What a trip. All of a sudden,
different type of boys trip.
This is what you do with a friend when you have money. You go off to Japan, Linda, and you have a vasectomy. You know?
And Pam, remember when John was talking about this? Pam goes, ew.
Yeah. That's right.
Really?
They went off and they had their twin, their buddy weekend was to go off to Japan and have vasectomies.
Wow.
And then Patty became pregnant, and Bob was very upset.
He was
ready to leave Patty.
Okay.
Because he said, "This cannot be my child. Because... it's impossible. We've had a vasectomy." But in Japan, they don't tie off the tubes. They just, what is it, cauterize? They cauterize them.
So you might as well not have one.
Exactly. And this is what happened. And so Bob got a paternity test. And as soon as he realized that, yes, this was his son, he had no issues and he married Patty and life went on. Mm. But Scott, once Bobby came out with the, see, that's not his son, that's not his son, Scotty went off and had a DNA test, and he used some of the DNA from the crime scene. Tell me if I'm getting this wrong, Carol, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
From the crime scene.
The lab result. Yeah. The lab result says these two have to be father and son. So Scott presented his findings publicly and to Bob B. And said, here's my test. I mean, and all you have to do is look at him. So it's a ridiculous assertion to make. But here's my test. Bob Crane is my father. You go and have a test. Nobody else had a test.
Yeah.
Only Scott had a test. Mm-hmm. But there is absolutely no denying that. It's a ridiculous assertion.
Absolutely none.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely none.
So what we do know.
Listening to this podcast, look them up side by side.
I mean, literally, just look
the
up
same guy.
Bob Crane's. All I did was look up Bob Crane's son, Scotty, and there's images of them right next to each other.
So you're saying side, he could play him
and
in the movie?
Look at it. Is what you're saying. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a younger Scotty is the version of loveliest, Bob Crane. Loveliest young man. Well, he's not young anymore. Like, I mean, I always picture him as a young man, but he's not a young man anymore. But Scotty,
when I was saying.
He's not young, but when I went to LA, last time I went to LA, Scott took me and my son Andrew all over Hollywood and told me all about Detonio, and he's a bit shorter than Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And but he's Bob's son.
He's Bob's son.
The
gestures, when I say
the way he speaks, they are the same guy. And you are absolutely right, by the way, because you did mention something about the rumor being about enhancements and think there were no enhancements. He needed no enhancements. There were no enhancements involved. And that really pinged off Patty, too, didn't it? She was really upset about that. But there were no artificial enhancements required. Bob was fine just as he was. Thank you.
Yeah. And you know, what's amazing is all of these things, all of these theories, rumors, and salaciousness comes out and it's being thrown. And it's like, we mentioned, it's like the game of telephone. Someone says it, and by the end of it, you get a whole other story. And it's a shame because it ruins people's legacies.
And it hurts the people who were close to him.
Oh yes.
And that's where we come at it, where you know, we see and feel the hurt that they have and that they feel, and by extension we feel that. So, you know, not only are we protective of Bob and we're protective of our information and our research, but we're protective of them as well. And so we're protective of Scotty, and we're protective of Karen, and we're protective of Jim and Charlie, and, you know, everybody who has trusted us and given of themselves and shared their recollections and their memories and their care and concern for their friend, their family member, you know, their coworker. They trusted us, and that's why we get so impassioned about it.
And we so important really do appreciate the fact that you were able to come on and tell us, because just here alone in this hour and a half that we've been talking, it's probably just even then scratching the surface of what you have. I mean, you have, you know, trails of information, which again, I hope people will read this book.
We didn't even go through his radio career, his full radio career. We didn't even really touch on it, other than a little tiny bit of KNX and a little tiny bit of WICC and LEA.
Television.
I mean, it just goes on and on. It's a full life. He lived 49 years.
Yes.
But in those 49 years, he packed so much life, more than most people do. And they live to be 80 or 100 years. He has so much in there, that when we do go on, and, you know, like in the beginning of this podcast episode, you know, you say, you know, just kind of talk and tell us, we could be here all night for us. Ooh. Linda, you know, Linda will be making her own dinner.
We guess people end up doing 2 and 3 part episodes.
Oh no, this is definitely going to be a 2-parter.
At an hour and a half already.
And we should, because, you know, a story like this, not only his story, but the work of you two ladies and authors like you, who really blood, sweat, tears, money, travel, time. Money. I mean, it costs money to go places.
Yeah.
And the patience, the, you know, relentless, to be relentless and track down these people. And I know it's not just one time, you do it time and time again. It's really commendable to see this all encapsulated in a book. It's really admirable. And I really hope that people who not only love Bob Crane, Hogan's Heroes, Hollywood stories, but just the stories of humans that had, like all of us, have our demons, if you want to call it that, or have our own things that we struggle with.
Our own specs on the Parthenon.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And it's really important to, I think Bob's story is one that gives us a visual, like a concrete example of why it's really important to be a critical reader and a critical thinker.
Yes.
When you're hearing these Hollywood stories, we won't even talk about Celebrity Cooks, about The Love Boat. The Love Boat, by the way, I suggest anybody who has an interest in Bob as a dramatic actor, find somewhere on your streaming services or whatever, find the first season of The Love Boat and watch that television episode of Bob playing a very serious character. It was a tremendous move for him as a serious actor. And it got cut short by his death. He would have gone on to do some amazing things.
Yeah, for sure.
But very important to when anyone reads about any actor or entertainer or anyone at all, for that matter, when you're reading an article or seeing something, be a critical thinker, be a critical reader.
Yes.
You know, there's an episode of our podcast. We do a podcast called Flipside.
Please tell us the name of that.
Sorry. We do our own. Okay. it's just about this book, but we do a podcast called Flipside, The True Story of Bob Crane. Flipside was the original working title of the book that became the definitive biography. And we get really in depth on some of the things that we talk about during that podcast. So for instance, we do a podcast on the television show Autopsy, The Last Hours of Autopsy. I was a guest on Autopsy last year when they were looking into, I don't know how, it was unusual to me because we know how Bob died, so autopsy not required to guess. However, they kind of delved into a few things and they got a lot of things right and they got a few things not so right. And so we, and again, taking from many sources, but things that they just presumed or concluded, and conclusions aren't always right if you have whole pictures, and there's nothing wrong with that. But for instance, what we did on our podcast was we actually had Scott on. Scott speaks to no one except us, for which we're very honored and privileged that he trusts us enough to talk to us. We had another guest who spoke to us anonymously, who was very close to Bob.
How often do you release, or is it done?
It's random.
Okay.
It's been kind of a bumpy year for me. So we're getting back into producing them, but this whole year has been extraordinarily crazy for me. So I haven't had any time to produce any of my podcasts.
So the name is Flipside is the name of the podcast.
The true story of Bob Crane.
Yeah. And the book is Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography, Linda Groundwater and Carol Ford. Just so there's a third, right? Just so I don't miss
there is D Young.
D Young. Okay, I don't want to miss anybody, you know, because everyone's worked really hard on this. But really, this has been amazing to listen to someone who, both of you, who've been, you know, head first into the waters that is the story of Bob Crane. And we really do appreciate that that you have taken the time, you know, that you've been patient with us to speak to us, and, you know, that you have given us all this information, because without people like you, it's all rumor and it's never going to be complete the way it is. So, you know, with that, we really do appreciate you guys coming on, and I hope to, you know, do this again. I mean, it'd be fun.
If I could, I want to share one quick story that kind of sums up really why we're here. It's a very quick story. When the book was released, it came out on September 17th, 2015, which was the 50th anniversary of Hogan's Heroes. And when it came out, I was in Hunt Valley, Maryland at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, and I was doing a presentation there. Scott had let me borrow his dad's Hogan 50 Mission Crusher cap. So I had that with me, which was really, really cool. Now that cap, and this is something like a whole nother thing, but the Liberty Aviation Museum in Port Clinton, Ohio, is the home of the Hogan's Heroes display. And they have Bob's entire Hogan costume, Clink's costume, Schultz's costume, the coffee pot.
A treasure trove.
I go there once a year to give presentations and whatnot. They're lovely, lovely people. They're up in Port Clinton, Ohio. And so if you ever can get there, get there.
Oh, you're in Ohio.
That's the point.
I am. Yeah.
I'm going to get there next year with you, Carol.
You better. But at Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention in 2015, I gave a presentation. I also had a table in the vendor hall. And when people came up to my table, a lot of people come up with a whole bunch of mixed emotions. It's like, oh, this is my favorite show. I love the show. Or, oh, yeah, I used to like that show, but ooh, him, why? Yeah. So there's like all this, you know, mixed emotion.
Yes. Coming
up. There was this one lady who came up, and she was, you know, I would say maybe in her 60s. And she said, you know, I used to love that show, but I never could watch that show again once I knew what I knew. And I said, you know, I said, why don't you come to my presentation tomorrow? She goes, oh, I don't know. I don't think so. And so I said, all right, but think about it. You know, I'm here all weekend, you know, come to my presentation tomorrow and maybe, you know, I'll think about it. So throughout the course of the whole that next day, and then that day, and then the whole next day, I saw her walking by, and she would kind of like do like this, and I'd be like, hi, are you gonna come to my presentation at 1 o'clock? And she's like, maybe, I'm not sure. And so, you know, that kind of went on. So my presentation came, and I gave my presentation, and I was really nervous. It was the first time I had presented about Bob. So I was sweating bullets the whole time that I was up there. And then afterwards, everybody came up to the podium to ask questions, and then also to get a closer look at the cap, at the Hogan cap. And I looked out, and there she was. She was standing there. And I was like, oh my gosh, you came. I'm so happy. And she was crying. And I'm like, oh, was I that bad? and she's standing there, and she's saying, thank you. You changed my negative perception of Bob Crane and gave me my show back. And
it's amazing what the truth will do.
Yeah.
It sums up why we did what we did and why we continue to do what we do. Like, we could have written the book and done our, you know, our events, and after 6 months been like, okay, that's it. But we stay with it. And we have the website, voteforbobcrane.org. We have our podcast, Flipside, the True Story of Bob Crane and Hogan's Heroes Review. We have tons of social media. We have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We have 2 Facebook pages.
One, how can people reach you, or how can they find you?
Voteforbobcrane.org. Vote for Bob Crane. It's vote4,
okay,
bobcrane.org. And that has everything. It has our YouTube channel, it has the podcast, it has the blog, it has the, you know, all of the information, all of our interviews. This one will be up on there as well.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you can always also email us, and we'll be able to then,
that's amazing,
email us the links, then we can put it on our
awesome. Our, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
And you can always find us on Facebook, and we do get messages sent to us on Facebook, and we're always happy to answer questions that people have as well. The biggest question we get is the one you asked us, who killed Bob Crane? Though it's the same one. We give people the same answer every time.
Everyone's going to ask theories. That.
Of course. Yeah,
there are many theories. We counted one day. I think I sat down one day and counted six active theories, mm-hmm. none of which were mine. But
can you email?
I think
you?
It's become.
Can you email us yours?
Yeah.
But
just email it to
you
us.
Know there are we'll there are like that many. The public. Family have that. The family have many theories. The you know the kids have their own theories. And other Everyone people have theories. Their theories. You know, people say the mob did it because Bob talks about the mob shortly before he dies in Scottsdale. Scottsdale was mm-hmm. known as. Having a bit of a mob presence, you know, it was a mob town, you know, he said, but if you look at how the mob works, I don't think it would have been that personal. Get it out if you're part of the mob. Yeah. But there are, you know, everybody, Hollywood loves a good mystery. Let's face it. Look at how many people watch crime and
right. You know, Duets is just,
it's all just those true crime channels and all that. People love that stuff. And there's no bigger story than a Hollywood story, a Hollywood crime with sex, a Hollywood crime with murder.
It hits all the boxes.
Every button. And so, you know, it's all there. But that is the question we get the most. And we will always tell them there are many theories.
Yeah.
No one will ever know. And that's it. I mean, that's it. But that's if it. People have questions, we are always happy to answer questions. We're always happy to give presentations. We're always happy to, because all we do, and although we have been portrayed as otherwise, we are not representatives of the Crane family. We only represent Bob and the people who spoke on his behalf who cannot speak any longer. So we speak for those who have spoken to us, and we tell the story of Bob the best way we can. And he is the only person that we represent, and only in as far as the things that we have been told and the things that we have learned through his own items, his own history. Those are the things that we represent. So we're always happy to discuss those things with people. But when people like yourselves, you know, bring attention, mm-hmm. we are so thrilled. And we were so happy to see that, you know, you took the time to go, hey, look, it's not some weirdo addict who's got a crazy life. Yeah. And look, he was murdered in sex and drugs. And wow, you yeah. know, and it was, and by the way, Bob didn't drink and he didn't do drugs, by the way.
Yeah.
Didn't drink at all. Didn't do drugs at all. Didn't smoke at all. This was not Bob. So, you know, but when people like you take the time to start, try to show him as a whole person, we don't expect people to whitewash that he had an addiction, but we also hope that people will say, here he is. He's a real person. He had a whole life. He did good things and he had demons just like all the rest of us. And we were so grateful that you did that. So thank you, ladies, so much for taking the time to show Bob as a whole person, despite his issues.
Yes. And I think it's come across quite clear that you are trying to put who he really is on the forefront.
Yes.
This just happens to be a part of his story.
Yes.
And that's correct. What it is. Everyone has chapters. That's a chapter of his story, but that's not his entire story. And, you know, and so with, you know, with that, really thank you, both of you, for speaking to us, giving us all these details that we, you know, we just nitpicked here, different things to put together, but you know, it's really beautifully done. And I hope that everyone, fan or not, of just the truth, or at least what people that know him told you, in a book. And it's Bob Crane, the definitive biography. And they probably can find it at every bookstore, correct? Or online, Amazon.
Online. Yeah. Okay. And send them questions. I mean, we don't know the answers. So
nobody does.
Nobody does.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
No, but ladies, you
guys know better.
Lovely.
Sure.
And we thank you. We really do.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you,
ladies.
Much.
Yes. And Carol, get some sleep, and Linda, start your day.
I'll get my hair cut. You know?
Start your day. There you go. Yeah. All right.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Having a Ball Podcast.
You can find us everywhere. We are on Having a Ball Pod on Instagram, Having a Ball Pod on Twitter. We are on Having a Ball Podcast on Facebook and Having a Ball Podcast on YouTube. And of course, if you want to send us any emails, comments, recommendations, Having a Ball Podcast at gmail.com. Thank you guys. Bye. Bye-bye.